And our guest today is Harrison Conley from Legislative Council. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. We've got a question on House Bill 2093, primarily centered on the third paragraph. And I want to give our members who have questions an opportunity to do so first, and then if there's anything left over, I've got one or two myself. Committee?
Question?
Certainly, Mr. Chair.
Representative Gardner.
Under three, it says a county employee that may not purchase, and also goes on further in line 16 to say that an actual conflict of interest is created under this section by discretionary action or decision of the county employee related to the acquisition. I guess my question is, how related to the acquisition does it have to be? I mean, is this perhaps a secretary who handled the file related to it, or how broad does that reach across the spectrum of employees for the county?
Chair Wilson, Representative Gardner, I believe that the intention here was to distinguish ministerial actions. The actions, ministerial actions, are those where the employee has very little discretion, little exercise of judgment. Essentially, they do follow a fairly clearly defined set of facts and handle the file in fairly nominal ways. I would say that the secretary who follows orders to file paperwork is performing a ministerial duty. The sheriff, who has some responsibilities around foreclosure and in fact conducting the sale, that person clearly would be exercising judgment.
Mr. Chair, if I might. The sheriff clearly would. How about a deputy who may or may not have had anything to do with it, but is an employee of the sheriff's office?
I think, as I recall the drafting on this, I believe that deputy would not, if the deputy had not had any role in the property, the deputy would not be forbidden from bidding at the auction.
How broad would his role have to be involved?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gardner, you're asking very ticklish questions around that issue. As I say, I can sort of tell you, you know, the discretion that ministerial duties are those which are largely fact-based, largely allow for no judgment, but it is difficult for me to say with finality exactly which employees or which duties are discretionary versus ministerial.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Conley. We see that an actual conflict of interest is not created by ministerial action. I can certainly understand that in your explanation there. Or decision of the employee. I'm having a hard time understanding that. I understand the ministerial action, and we have no conflict created by that. But also, then I could read that an actual conflict of interest is not created by a decision of a county employee. I don't know where to go with that. And that, of course, is in line 18.
The line that says an actual conflict of interest is created by discretionary action or decision of county employee related to acquisition, management, sale, but is not created by. I'm sorry, I'm not quite sure I understand.
Okay, in line 18, I understand what you've said about a ministerial action not creating the actual conflict of interest, but the words after ministerial action include or decision of the county employee. So I'm wondering then that I could eliminate the phrase by ministerial action and just say an actual conflict of interest is not created by a decision of the county employee. I hope I'm not jumping to conclusions there, but I'm just trying to understand how the words or decision of the county employee fit in with the general thought there.
I think the intention here was that ministerial modifies action and decision. So it is a ministerial decision or a ministerial action. That was certainly my intent in drafting this provision, and it may be that I need to clarify.
I see what you're saying. Okay, thank you. Any further questions for Mr. Conley, Representative Mark?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think certainly high standards are needed, and especially elected officials. But what about the case of, say, we're dealing with the assessment and taxation or the tax collector's office on this, but there's someone over in planning who has sort of insider information that there's going to be a rezoning of the property, or they're planning a rezoning of the property. Does this get to that individual and prevent that individual from purchasing the property?
Mr. Chair, Representative March, I have to admit it's been some time since I have looked at this piece of work. It certainly would have been intended to catch that kind of an employee who uses inside information. We certainly intended to distinguish employees who have no role related to the property. For example, someone who a garbage collector certainly was somebody who had no relation, and we were trying to make sure that employees who had no opportunity to influence the decision to foreclose on property for the tax lien, who had no opportunity to participate in the sheriff's decision making around the sale action. That was the intent, to make sure that those employees were not able to benefit from inside information. Frankly, I would probably need to spend a little more time reviewing the draft to really give you a clear answer as to whether someone like the planner, who doesn't really play a direct role but who does sort of have this inside information, this information that's not, that may be readily available to the public, but certainly not as readily as that official's basis for knowledge.
Thank you. Representative Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Conley, to what extent is the process for foreclosure on real property on the county level discretionary, and to what extent is it prescribed in detail by law?
Mr. Chair, Representative Devlin, there is a fairly detailed description of the process by which the sheriff forecloses.
Mr. Chairman, does the sheriff, though, have discretion in that process? I mean, is it after a certain period of time, a certain amount of taxes that are due, can the sheriff delay, or can they advance a foreclosure on a property?
Mr. Chair, Representative Devlin, I guess I would love the opportunity to go back and review all of these issues to be able to respond to your questions better. However, the sheriff does not actually make the decision to foreclose on overdue taxes. I believe that taxes must be overdue by 3 years, I want to say, 2 or 3 years of overdue taxes before the foreclosure occurs, and then there's a substantial opportunity for the person to redeem the property even after foreclosure.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Who administratively makes the decision ultimately for foreclosure? Is it the county clerk, or is it the county commission? And do they have discretion in that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Devlin, to the best of my recollection, it is the assessor who would ultimately make the call that taxes are overdue by the 2 or 3 year period required.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Committee, I would be happy to entertain your questions if you insist. We've got a couple of representatives who do need to get back to committees as soon as possible, and Representative Schrader is here to testify on the following bill here. But if you do have something you'd like to ask now, if you just move along quickly. Anyone?
I have a question, but I can ask it later. If
you'd be satisfied to ask it later, we will
do that,
because this will be back.
I can do it later.
All right, Mr. Conley, thank you very much.
Thank you.
It's an interesting idea, and may well be something that is needed. Representative Close, if you would continue to work with legislative counsel on that, to sharpen that, we'd certainly be willing to bring that back. Okay, with nothing else on this, we've exhausted our list of those who are wanting to testify. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2093, and we will open the public hearing on House Bill 2458, Representative Schrader.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. This bill may look familiar to some of you from last session. Basically, House Bill 2458 prevents an existing city, well, I guess I should identify myself. I am Kurt Schrader, State Representative, House District 23. Basically, this bill prevents an existing city from unilaterally vetoing a proposed community's incorporation before the community even has the opportunity to do an economic feasibility study, and that is important juxtaposition because that's the genesis of this bill. Similar bill did pass both houses overwhelmingly last session, but was vetoed by the governor. We established an interim work group that included members of LCDC, Associate Oregon Counties, League of Oregon Cities, Metro, Citizens, and the governor's office to try and work out a solution. The offending provision has been eliminated from the bill that's now before you, and several new refinements have also been included to satisfy some technical concerns of the Department of Justice. The bill in its current form does eliminate the veto over incorporation in favor of an arbitration process by county commissioners with an appeal to LUBA. So we still preserve the existing city's preeminent right to help determine what happens in their vicinity. The basic idea here, again, is to allow citizens to do an economic feasibility study and yet protect existing cities' right to have significant influence in the process. What does all that gibberish mean? Bottom line was, give you an example, little town outside of Oregon City called Beaver Creek, that happens to be in my district, wanted to look at incorporation. They thought that this may be something they'd want to do. They were prepared to do it at urban level densities and provide urban level services, or at least explore that. They had a lot of meetings, had overwhelming input from citizens for the size of that town, and they thought, well, we'll do a study to see if this really makes sense. Well, they ran into a catch-22. When they went out looking for funding sources to do the study, they found that there were several different players willing to participate, county, metro, Land Conservation Development Commission, Economic Development Department, and they all were willing, but they said, well, we don't want to spend that money if Oregon City is just going to veto your proposal. And Oregon City basically said, well, you know, we're not against you guys doing that. We have no desire to annex this particular community, but the problem is it depends on what you come up with. If you came up with a weird plan or proposal, then, yeah, we might want to actually veto that. So we don't want to give that up altogether. So on one hand, they couldn't get the feasibility study done until the veto was given up. And on the other hand, the community nearby was willing to do that, but then again, not willing to do it depending on what they came up with. So that's really the genesis of this bill. And that's why what the bill does is allow for the economic feasibility study to go forward and yet protect the existing city's rights to intervene in the process. And indeed, frankly, it gives them a bit of a preeminent right through the county commission, existing county commission, and LUBA, so that if this does not pencil out, there are some controls. This particular bill limits the incorporation areas that could incorporate to what we call rural and incorporated communities, and that's defined in the bill, and exception lands in the Portland metropolitan area, Tri-County area, and in other areas of the state. There are exception lands where there's a certain amount of recognized urban-level development already there. The idea here is to limit sprawl, kind of acknowledge this existing urbanization in our land use laws. Frankly, for my standpoint, coming from the Canby area, which is just south of the Metropolitan Service District, it's a way to prevent paving over some of the best farmland in the state of Oregon and yet deal with the increased population pressures we're seeing and hopefully provide cost-effective urban service delivery. I think more importantly, perhaps, or just as importantly, this also brings citizens into the process once again, instead of having a bureaucracy deal with how we deal with our citizens' land use process, gives them a sense of community or an opportunity to preserve that sense of community and, quite frankly, do some self-determination. Now, an issue has risen. This work group's met, and we've done a lot of communicating. As the bill has come forward, there's been a little more renewed interest in looking at this closely. And an issue has arisen regarding, well, geez, what if we want to allow for incorporation within an urban growth boundary? My bill, as it stands now, deals with a corporation outside of the urban growth boundary, allows that to happen. That was the big issue last session the governor had the most problems with. But as time has gone on, there may be a reason to want to have the ability to incorporate within the urban growth boundary, particularly the Metropolitan Service District. So currently talked with several of the members and maybe wanting to testify here, some of the groups that we've been working with, saying that what we would do is probably add a section of the bill that would restore the three-mile veto, but within the urban growth boundary. So allows this process to go forward on exception lands and rural unincorporated communities. They can develop their own thoughts, feasibility studies, possibly go through this process, not be shut down. And yet within the urban growth boundary, we would have that three-mile veto still in existence to allow the city's little greater control over what goes on. And quite frankly, the way the bill was originally written, we didn't catch, is that if we pass this, there would be no ability for them to incorporate in an urban growth boundary. So this, by going back to that veto within an urban growth boundary, allows that to occur should they want to go there. That's basically it.
Thank you, Representative Devlin.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Representative Schrader, when you say that the amendment that might be proposed would allow a veto within the UGB, would that be a veto within the UGB for incorporation that is totally within the UGB also? So the way that with this amendment, it would not allow a city to veto, even though they were inside the UGB, if the place that was incorporating was outside the UGB.
That is correct.
Second, Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Secondarily, on Section 3, page 2, where it starts off looking at these requirements, how clearly did your work group in examining these clearly would define where the terms rural community, service center, rural center, a resort community? How clearly did you find those defined?
We did not revisit that. That was language from the previous bill.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, this is an unfair question, Representative Schrader.
Go ahead, Richard.
There are approximately about 70,000 acres of exception lands in Clackamas County outside the urban growth boundary. Do you know how many of these rural communities, service centers, rural centers, resort communities might qualify under this bill for incorporation?
I do not. The idea was to be somewhat limiting by having these are already acknowledged in the Department of Land Conservation and Development Survey of Oregon Unincorporated Communities. And I'll just add, as you remember, when the original comprehensive plans were drafted for a lot of the counties, they frankly just left these off the map like they didn't even exist. So it seemed logical to recognize them and try and confine some of the urban level development that might indeed be coming down the pike to areas that were already urbanizing.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Certainly. Any other questions?
All right. Thank you very much.
Next up to testify will be Dick Jones from Clackamas and Eugene Schoenheit, or Schoenheit, if you would join him. I'd appreciate that. Thank you.
You want me now?
Please, yes. If you'd come up as a panel, that would be great. I'll let the two of you decide. Why don't you go first, and if you would identify yourself for the record, I'd appreciate it as you begin to speak.
Good afternoon. My name is Dick Jones, and I live in Oak Grove. Appreciate the opportunity, Chair Wilson, to come and present my comments. Appreciate this opportunity to speak on House Bill 2458. As Representative Schrader has already said, House Bill 2458 is very similar House Bill 2463 from the 1999 session, which I also was involved with discussions on and before the same committee. And there was a lot of support for this bill in my community. I have, before I started preparing my comments and thoughts recently, I sat down and took some time to read the governor's veto letter that was dated July 22, 99. Perhaps some of the new members of the committee don't have that, and I took the liberty to attach a copy of the governor's letter. I perceive his arguments focus on two real issues. In paragraph 2, he expressed concerns that the neighboring cities are assumed responsibility, that the neighboring city has assumed the responsibility to plan for and to provide the urban services to the unincorporated area. And in paragraph 5, his concern is that the area has negotiated intergovernmental agreements designed to provide sewer, water, fire, police protection in place which incorporation may upset the balance. And I would agree that these are both very valid concerns and certainly should be discussed in the discussion of House Bill 2458. As written, it would, unfortunately, eliminate new cities wholly within the urban growth boundary, like the area where I live. And it really puts our community of over 30,000 people in a catch-22 situation. The people in our community do not want to be annexed to City A, and the city councilors of City B have stated they don't want to have a larger city. And the question is, how do residents, community leaders, address the incorporation issue under such a situation? My concerns with House Bill 2458 are as follows. Section 3(2)(a) limit the incorporation to areas entirely within the urban reserves and rural unincorporated areas. This will limit the forming of new cities only around the fringe of the existing urban growth boundaries, and this simply removes the possibility of an area like Oak Lodge becoming a city. And I think Representative Schrader well framed this in his discussions. I would suggest a change to Section 3(2)(a) that after agricultural lands or forest lands and before the period, the following perhaps could be added. Or if the area proposed to be incorporated lies entirely within the urban growth boundaries, local special districts must supply three or more urban services listed in ORS 195-065-4 at the effective date of this act to over 90% of the residents. In the case of our community, my suggested changes would cover the issues addressed in the governor's veto letter on House Bill 2463 from 99. Oak Lodge has supplied urban services to its residents via a number of special districts, which are independent of any of our neighboring cities, including fire, water, sewer. And to divert for a system, we do not only just have a water system, we have a water processing plant on the Clackamas River that's less than 2 years old. We also participate in a special taxing district in Clackamas County for police protection, as do several of the cities in Clackamas County. Thank you for this opportunity to testify before you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Jones. Do we have any questions? All right, we do not.
Sure. Well, Eugene Schoenheit. I'm a resident of Oak Grove and the general area. Dick pretty much taught most of my points. But let me tell you a little bit about Oak Grove. To the north of us, we have Milwaukee. To the west of us, we have the river. Across, we have Lake Oswego. To the south, we have Gladstone. Out east, we have, what's the name of that trailer park now? Johnson City. And pretty much unincorporated farther out east. The area itself is already urban and self-supporting. And, we're not going into the county. We don't have farmland. We're, inside the urban growth boundary. That's about it. That explains where our location is. We'd like to consider becoming a city, yet we're surrounded by other cities that, wish to say no. We have, all the basic services, and we didn't mention that we do have a sewer plant that's actually capable of handling the needs into the future and then some, that some of the other service districts are considering using part of our sewer plant for capacity. But we're pretty much, self-sufficient as we sit.
Okay. Thank you. Do we have any questions? All right, gentlemen, thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. I'd like to call Dan Cooper, Metro, please.
Mr. Chair, I'm members of the committee. I'm Dan Cooper, general counsel for Metro. With me, I have Fawn McNeely from PacWest, who PacWest is our legislative lobby representative down here in Salem, and she works with us. As most of you know, Metro is the elected regional government in the Portland area that is responsible to the voters for regional land use planning pursuant to our voter-approved charter, as well as the state statutes adopted by the legislature. House Bill 2458 deals with the process and criteria for incorporating new cities and would have a potentially major effect on this process. Representative Schrader has kindly asked us to review this bill. We worked with him last session on a similar bill. We believe we understand why he seeks this bill in order to allow certain rural communities outside of existing urban growth boundaries to become cities so that those residents can control their own destiny. We are concerned that the bill would have the unintended consequence of making it virtually impossible to create new cities inside the metro urban growth boundary as needed land is added to the urban growth boundary to meet the requirements of state law. I've submitted to you a proposed technical amendment that would provide for the new rules proposed in this bill to apply outside of urban growth boundaries and existing law to continue to apply inside an urban growth boundary. Pursuant to the statutory authority that the legislature created two sessions ago, Metro has adopted criteria for new cities inside its boundary that would continue to be applicable. This would allow Metro and the cities and counties inside the Metro boundary to continue our cooperative process for planning for future growth and at the same time allow areas outside urban areas to incorporate if they so desire. Thank you very much. The proposed amendment that I've sent around is probably one way of recrafting this bill and certainly isn't the final answer to anything you've want to do, but I just had it prepared as a suggested way of getting there, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Cooper. Could you give us the executive summary of what your amendment attempts to do here?
It reinstates the three-mile rule inside of urban growth boundaries.
All right. Thank you. Representative Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Cooper, it's been a long time since we've been in this.
I've managed to avoid it.
That's an inside. With the amendment that you're proposing, where a city within an urban growth boundary could reject an incorporation within 3 miles, is your reading of your amendment that if the area that was incorporating was outside the urban growth boundary but within 3 miles, they could not object or they could not veto?
Well, the statute would, if the land was entirely outside of an urban growth boundary, then the bill as proposed by Representative Schrader would apply, and that city would be involved in the process but would not have an absolute right to object. If some of the land straddled the urban growth boundary, you'd have a different answer. If it was entirely inside the urban growth boundary, then a neighboring city would have a right to object. Now, one of the things that's sort of important to understand here is there is a relationship between moving urban growth boundaries in Goal 14 and creating cities. If land is inside an urban growth boundary, then you've dealt with all of the Goal 14 issues, and you don't have the barrier of the land use planning laws on creating a city that Representative Schrader's bill recognizes that city must be able to satisfy once if it's going to incorporate outside of an existing urban growth boundary. So they truly are two different situations.
Mr. Chairman, just a couple of follow-ups.
Certainly.
Then, Mr. Cooper, in your case, that if the land is directly adjacent to the existing urban growth boundary, then they still might have the veto, or they may still have the veto under
Beaver Creek, to use the example, lies immediately adjacent to the metro jurisdictional boundary, the urban growth boundary, and the city limits of Oregon City. It's outside of all three of those, and as the bill has been introduced, the Beaver Creek area can go through the petition process, do the feasibility study, and the adjacent city, which in that case the only one down there that's within 3 miles is Oregon City, would have a right to go through the process in front of the Clackamas County Commission.
Not a veto.
But not a veto.
Okay. Mr. Chairman,
follow up.
You love land use.
And I don't know the answer to the 70,000-acre question either.
Okay. I won't ask that. Where a city inside the urban growth boundary is annexing outside the urban growth boundary into a completely rural area, but that rural area is adjacent to another city, how would it be covered under a version of the bill?
Well,
you know exactly the area I'm describing.
The under Goal 14 and Metro's rules right now that apply inside our territory, that annexation cannot happen until after the urban growth boundary is moved first. And I believe that in the rest of the state, the land use decision to annex the land would require that the same findings you'd have to make for moving the urban growth boundary would have to occur at the same time or prior to the annexation into the city, because annexation is in effect a decision to urbanize, and urbanization can only happen in those areas where you followed the Goal 14 process. And so the answer is it doesn't happen.
Mr. Chairman, final question,
follow up.
Since it's been some time since I've dealt with this, and I know that, I don't know, what, this last session or so, we got rid of the Boundary Commission.
It was two sessions ago.
Two sessions ago. It all runs together. Who ultimately makes boundary decisions in the metropolitan area and in counties outside the metropolitan area?
With the exception of Lane County, where there still is a Boundary Commission, cities make, everywhere in the state, cities make the primary decisions on annexations, and counties, the county commissioners, make the decisions on annexations to special districts and formations of new cities or new special districts. Within the metro region, pursuant to the legislation you adopted when the Portland Boundary Commission was abolished, there's a separate appeal process for governmental challenges to governmental decisions about annexations and boundary changes that leads to an independent appeals board that's been appointed by Metro to resolve those governmental disputes. But that's not where citizens take their complaints. Citizens would have to take their appeals directly through the land use process, which leads to LUBA and then the Court of Appeals.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Maybe good news and bad news. Bad news is there will be a test on this one. Good news is we're going to grade on the curve.
The multiple choice.
All right. Thank you very much. Bob Rendy, DLCD, please. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bob Rendy, and I'm with the Department of Land Conservation and Development. I'm grateful that we were asked to review this and to be involved in both last session and this one. But I will give you quickly the caveat that I know very little about annexation law and that we don't deal with it, and I don't think there's anyone in the agency that does. So some of the very difficult technical questions about land that's just outside of Metro or just outside of the cities is not something that we particularly have looked at. We are neutral on this bill, and we were neutral last session. We were satisfied. I wanted to explain to you what our concern has been. We would not want to see an area incorporate for the purpose of preventing urban development. And the reason we're concerned about that, and I won't name names, but there is a city in the Portland metro area that a number of years ago declined to accept a certain amount of growth and density and urban services. And ultimately that worked its way into LCDC and Goal 10 and even the enforcement process. And it's certainly, I think, common knowledge that perhaps it's, you can't prove this, but that area was incorporated as a measure of defense against accepting, I think, a certain amount of growth in the metro area. We don't want to see that happen. Urban growth boundaries are intended to accommodate 20 years worth of growth, and that is, I think, a fair trade-off for measures that are on the books to preserve farm and forest land. Our role is to make sure that land in an urban growth boundary does accept its fair share of affordable housing, commercial industrial development, and growth that is needed to come to that area. So we early on looked at this and tried to make sure that there are provisions that make sure that any new city, such as a new city adjacent to or in the metro area, would certainly be understanding as they vote on incorporation that it's their responsibility to accept a certain amount of the growth of that region. And I think we're pretty assured that those provisions are here. There are a couple of minor glitches, and we did note these to Representative Schrader the other day. I'll mention on page 2, line 9, that the language that's been taken out required petitions to follow a variety of other things. The line says, in addition to the requirements, and then it referred back to 1 and 2. As we put in a new section 2, we didn't get that line in, and therefore it looks to me inadvertently that there's a series of requirements that normally happen to incorporating cities that wouldn't happen to cities that are within 3 miles. And I don't think that was intended, and so I'll just raise that as a technical point. Our concern is that on section 3C, capital C, on page 3. It refers to a density established by LCDC. And we don't have a rule that specifically establishes a density except in the metro area. And in that case, it only establishes densities that sort of target densities for cities to plan for, and it names the specific cities. So to the extent that you'd have a new city, they wouldn't be named by that. So this is a null set, and there really isn't any provision right now in DLCD rule that establishes a density. I'm not sure that that's a major problem. I think we can fix it by referring instead to Metro's requirements for densities. I understand they have some. I think we can do it that way, or there might be another way, but we did want to make sure that you understood there was something here that I think needed some repair in that regard. Finally, I understand that, you know, there's this push and pull about whether or not we'll have lands within the Metro UGB incorporating and becoming a new city. And that wasn't particularly our issue. I think you'll hear that from cities. We would like that to have that resolved in a way that doesn't make it difficult for a newly incorporated city just outside the metro boundary to come into that boundary, either just prior to or just subsequent. And I don't know how that language and how that whole situation with Oak Grove is going to be resolved. But I think there are areas that are incorporated communities that are adjacent to the Metro UGB that are in fact, are good locations for future growth in that area. And we wouldn't want something in this bill to prevent those areas from coming into the UGB with the intent of being a city, a fully participating city in the UGB. So I think it's going to be tricky how we write that language, and we want it to continue to be at the table as that happens.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Rendy, on page 2 of the bill, section 3, subsection B, same question I asked Representative Schrader, but not to identify how many are within that 70,000 acres. But how clearly are these defined in state statute, these terms rural community, service center, rural center, resort community? Would it be possible to identify who might choose to utilize this law by those definitions?
Mr. Chair, Representative Devlin, those definitions come from Land Conservation and Development Commission rules. Back in 1991 or 92, somewhere many years ago, LCDC adopted an extensive set of rules, and by the way, it had broad support, bipartisan, a whole range of interests, to allow special planning for unincorporated communities, and these terms were all drawn from that rule. And in fact, this is one of the difficulties you get. And there's increasingly we see the land use statutes reference terms that are not defined in the statutes themselves. They come from our rules, and I don't understand. I'm not an attorney on that. I think it's a problem. But right now, the LCDC has a set of detailed definitions for each of those terms. And so I presume, as you looked at these terms, if you looked also at the DLCD rule, you'll be able to find the additional detail you'd need in order to determine whether you're one of these. And we recently amended that rule to add this survey, which I think pretty much encompasses anything else in the four terms above. The survey is very exhaustive and lists all kinds of rural communities.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Mende, the way this reads, these areas would have to have been identified in the community plans as one of these categories already. That's your reading?
Correct, or listed on this survey. And again, I think the survey is very, I can't remember the number, I think it's around 500 unincorporated place names that are on that survey, and an awful lot of places that are unincorporated, and many of which may not be identified yet in comp plans, but they would be drawn in by this definition.
Mr. Chairman, mm-hmm. Not that any other committee member would be interested in this or want that much detail, but Mr. Rende, could you provide me with a copy of that survey and identified?
Absolutely.
Anybody else want it?
I will be sure to queue up for that. any further questions? All right, thank you very much. Appreciate that. Next up would be Burton Weiss, special. Oh, excuse me. Let me have Burton stand by for just a moment. League of Oregon Cities, Linda Ludwig, and City of Milwaukee, Martha Bennett.
Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, members of the committee. Linda Ludwig from the League of Oregon Cities. I've brought with me today Martha Bennett from the City of Milwaukee to talk a little bit about House Bill 2458. You've heard the background on it, and currently we have had the opportunity to participate during the interim in the discussions that have happened with this bill, and very much thanks to Representative Schrader for that. We think we're close. We would like the opportunity to spend the next couple of weeks continuing to work on some of the language on the bill. We do have some concerns and see if we can't bring back a better product for you. Briefly, I can outline several of those concerns today.
If I can ask you to correspond those concerns to sections of the bill specifically, we can go to and mark our bills here.
Certainly, Mr. Chair. The first issue is one that's already been brought up, Section 1, 4, A, and B. We would request that you do not delete this portion of the bill. This would allow existing cities to approve proposed incorporations as currently provided by law within the UGB, while still allowing the petition process as outlined later in the bill to affect the land outside the UGB. Secondly, Section 3.1c, we would ask that a change be added here to either add language that would add the Metropolitan Service District to that descriptor, or actually change the language to lies outside and add of any urban growth boundary striking of any city. That would make this applicable to the Metropolitan Service District, which we feel is in all of our best interest. That third bullet there, Section 2C, you heard Bob Rindy's comments about the density requirements as outlined in the bill. our alternative to that would be to add that the proposed new city demonstrate a 20-year buildable residential land supply as required for other incorporated cities. This is really a fairness issue for us. Existing cities are required to have a 20-year buildable land supply, and we would like any other proposed incorporated cities to also demonstrate that. Section 2A, along those same lines, we would add that if the proposed new city meets the threshold requirements to develop public facility plans and transportation system plans, they should have to demonstrate some ability to complete those plans, going through that process at the time of incorporation. And to the extent that they might rely on relying cities for their extensions of services, at least show that some sort of agreements between the cities, DLCD, have been ascertained or will be shortly. And lastly, that last bullet, we do have some concerns with the way the bill is currently written, with how exception lands are described, and I have talked with Representative Schrader about this, and I think we can narrow the language to make this suitable and more understandable for us. Again, we would like to request that we have a little more time with this bill, and that you might hear Martha Bennett's comments as well.
Thank you. Questions? Ms. Bennett.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I want to outline just briefly what the goals of cities like Milwaukee are in this bill. We certainly, our first goal is actually very similar to Representative Schrader's. We believe in local self-determination. That's what city governments are all about. So we understand and support that goal. But we have four other things we'd like you to take into consideration as you deal with this bill. The first is that any new city should be a full-service community. It should be viable. We shouldn't allow the creation of cities that can't provide services, both in terms of planning services, but also high-quality municipal services. You need to make sure that you pass that basic test for a new city. Second is that you don't want an incorporation of a new city to threaten or jeopardize the health of an existing or nearby city. That's what the three-mile rule was all about, and we hope that you'll still preserve that part of the intent of the three-mile rule and any legislation you might adopt. The third is that you need to create a level playing field. New cities that are created need to have the same rules and restrictions that apply to existing cities. And last, we don't want you to create, this is odd coming from someone who works in government, any additional layers of government that create conflict or competition among governments that doesn't need to exist right now. Some of the concerns I've raised do relate very specifically to that question of how do you treat cities that are inside urban growth boundaries versus outside of them. For example, the jeopardizing the health of existing cities really does deal with that whole, are you inside an urban growth boundary or outside? And that's really all we have to say at this point. I'd be happy to answer questions.
Thank you. Questions? All right. Thank you very much. And to bat cleanup here today will be Burton Weiss in Special Districts.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Burton Weist. I'm here on behalf of the Special Districts Association of Oregon. We, too, have had an opportunity to participate on this bill, and we don't have any particularly objections to the bill. I would like to point out, if you could turn to page 3 of the bill, the line 2, subsection large A. This is the economic feasibility statement, would indicate that the proposed city must provide urban services in a cost-effective manner at the minimum level. Just for the record, I'm not sure an amendment is required, but I think there is some legislative history required here, that just what that sentence means. There is hardly a city in Oregon that does not receive some service from a special district, including the city of Portland and the city of Milwaukee. For example, ORS 195, which is discussed in this bill, talks about five specific kinds of services, and those are water, sewer, parks, transportation, and fire. And Senate Bill 122, which enacted ORS 195, you've all heard that bill in the past, that bill required that agreements be adopted between cities, counties, and special districts on the provision of those services, and those are the so-called urban service agreements, which are part of periodic review and approved by LCDC. You could read the language in sub 2 to say that that city must provide all those urban services. If that was the case, you would effectively be preventing the creation of just about any new city, because it would be almost impossible for a current unincorporated community, or one of the criteria that are in this bill, to form and provide all those cities themselves. To use Beaver Creek as an example, they are well within the boundaries of a large regional fire district, Clackamas Fire District Number 1, which covers a broad area, including going all the way down to Milwaukee and Oak Grove. And Oak Lodge, which has been discussed, those are in the same district as Beaver Creek, which is several miles away. So it'd be very difficult for them to create their own fire district or own fire department in a very small community like this in the middle of a very large regional district. The nearest water system to Beaver Creek is a city consortium of Westland and Oregon City, South Fork Water Board. The nearest sanitary services is the Tri-City Sewer District, which is operated by Clackamas County. So the moral of the story is that language either needs, we either need to have a very strong legislative history that indicates by proposed city must provide, means they either have to contract or have a provision for providing it through some other unit of government to have that full service city, or we need to amend the bill to make it say they either provide or contract or are within an existing service district that provides that. Otherwise, I don't think any of these areas in the state of Oregon would be likely to ever be able to use this bill.
Thank you. Further questions? All right. Thank you. Representative Schrader, could I have to come back for a return visit?
Absolutely. Just as long as Representative Devlin doesn't get to ask me any more questions.
I'll take care of Representative Devlin. Representative Schrader, you've had an opportunity to listen to the various ideas for amendments and so forth. Would you like to make any general or specific statement about any of those and where you have to go to be comfortable with?
Sure. Appreciate the opportunity, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. As alluded to, I have worked with the various individuals who come up to testify. I don't have a problem with any of their general recommendations. They do not undermine the original intent of the bill at all, and indeed, I think, make the bill a little bit better. Whether or not I'll agree with absolutely every little detail that the League of Oregon Cities wants to do, that I'm not sure I'll go quite there, but we'll discuss that, and certainly they've been willing to come forward at least quite a long ways from last session. But I think the comments go right along with what we're trying to do, which is not cause extra roadblocks, not make things too simple that we undo what process we have here, but as I think the committee probably recognizes, any change, especially for the players that have been up before you here today, is always a little unnerving. And so I respect that in their own way, but I would hope that we can still bring our land use process forward without relying on an old bureaucratic solution, make things a little bit more citizen involvement oriented, allow self-determination, and frankly, in my opinion, make our whole land use process a little bit better than it is right now. So I think we're okay.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
I see we have no questions.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Devlin.
This is not a question, but I look forward to Representative Schrader returning to the committee with his bill, and I'll try to give him some advance warning as a question when he returns.
That would be appropriate. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Representative Schrader. We will close the public hearing on House Bill 2458 and do expect to see this one again. No further business on the agenda. No announcements. We're adjourned.